today on the Shelley Irwin Show podcast from WGVU, the author of the book Always November, Blue Cross Blue Shield Nourishing Communities, The American Red Cross Blood Shortage, the author of Running with Lions, and Anne Frank, the exhibition at the Griffin Museum in Chicago. All coming up on the Shelley Irwin Show podcast from WGVU.
The book is Always November. The author, Eric Housley, with us. Let's talk about a moment in time that will always be with you. We know Eric, and perhaps with us as this America in which we live. Your 18-year-old daughter, Elena, was murdered during a mass shooting. You do a lot of positive outreach, including talking at schools, working with families, and now, obviously, writing a book. Eric, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And that's A-R-I-K. Thank you for that. Your world shattered when your 18-year-old daughter, Elena, was murdered, along with 11 others, that mass shooting at the Borderline Bar and Grill in Thousand Oaks, California. Does it ever get easier to discuss?
Yeah. I mean, it really does. It actually gets easier when you discuss it and you don't kind of try to suppress it. At least that's what I've found in my journey.
Yes. Your book is Always November, Lessons in Loss, Love, and Resilience, described as a courageous memoir of a dad's journey through sorrow, a family's unbreakable bond, and, of course, more. Did you face a choice to be consumed by grief or to grow bigger around it, Eric?
Yeah, you know, it really pulls families apart or pushes them together. More often than not, it pulls them apart, and we really... You know, in that journey, we found times to like really communicate with one another, find the time to do it. We allowed our community to love us and to be there for us, which was very freeing in many ways, and allowed us to let them in. We were just so embraced by their presence from the get-go.
Can you talk a little bit about Elena before I get more into your themes?
Yeah, I mean, she was a nerd, super smart. She got it from her mother, obviously. And she but was always outgoing and getting others to feel a part of at school and other places. We found a lot about that after. But yeah, very kind-hearted and always was wanting to help and do for others. It was her first night out, chose to go dancing. We actually encouraged her to go out because she had been studying a lot. And then the life, you know, things changed, right?
Yes. Always November. Why the title?
So the shooting happened on November 7th, 2018. And, you know, it's that approach every year when November starts to roll around, that kind of, there's that somber feeling. At the same time, so much love is present in the process. So you just start to feel that, you know, I know you've lost somebody in your life, right? And there's a time of year where all of a sudden it comes around to their birthday or, you know, in our scenario, because it was such a tragic, you know, scenario of a mass shooting, that it's, you know, it's just that reminder to stop, be present, find humanity, find time, take a breath, and regroup.
Let me ask about a few of the lessons that you are sharing. You remind us to live with tragedy, not in tragedy. What does this mean?
You know, some people get all consumed by it, and then it just takes them down a road. I heard of somebody, I was just at a conference speaking a couple days ago, and there's a woman that, you know, 8 years later, that's just so consumed on trying to get more answers, even though the outcome is sadly the outcome that's the inevitable that they already know. So we chose as a family just not to know the details when they gave us the police report, how she died, where she died. Obviously that was obvious, but it's, other than that, the extra details, those didn't change it. So it didn't, when I would wake up with nightmares, it wouldn't be real for me, because I fortunately wasn't there to witness. And again, this journey is different for everybody. So some people are there and they are witnesses, and that's such a different way for them to handle it. You've also got the families that are dealing with the shooter in the scenario for Elena took his own life. So I don't have to relive it every time he comes up for parole like some people. So it's easy for me to say it from my scenario of how we've handled it, but we all do this a little different.
And obviously you are an example of turning pain into purpose. Unimaginable grief can become a catalyst for growth.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, somebody said it on my podcast recently. They said, you know, when somebody said, oh, time heals all wounds. And she says, why would I want this wound to heal? This pain that I have in losing my mother, she says, just reminds me of how much I loved her and I still love her today. And it's just understanding how to bear that pain, you know, how to feel it and feel the love within it. But not be all consumed by it. And that's difficult, especially for people that have gone through tragedy, because you want to, but many times it's just really pulls people apart in that way.
The book is Always November, Lessons in Love, Loss, and Resilience, where my author, Eric Housley, writes on about the 18-year-old daughter, Elena, who was murdered during a mass shooting. Got to be blunt in our conversation. Tell me, if I may ask, you ask us and remind us to value each moment.
Yeah, I mean, really, every day we are one day closer to our last day, right? You and I both today is one day closer. What we don't know what that is. And so we have to tell the ones we love that we love them. Tell them, you know, if you've got a beef with your brother or sister and you haven't talked for years, does it really matter that much who was right when you really, at the end, you know, all of this stuff doesn't matter in that way. And there are times where I could say that could differ. But at the most time, if you really feel like you would regret that, if tomorrow was the last day, if the doctor said, oh my gosh, your brother, whoever just passed, that you would regret it, then say it, then put it behind you, move forward, because being there, loving one another, supporting one another is way, way much more important for people in that way.
And Eric, communication surrounding grief, how does one speak with someone that is processing grief? What do you want others to say to you?
It's funny. One of my pet peeves was the I have no words, and some people love that because, you know, and I think of, well, then don't say anything if you don't have any words. The biggest mistake I think people say is they say what they think they would want to hear. So imagine a strong Christian woman who just lost her daughter, and right now she might be angry with God. And if you were to turn to her and say, oh, she's with God right now, she might not react the way you would expect. But maybe in a year or two she does. So it's really difficult to know what to say. My suggestion is less is more. Just say, I'm really thinking of you today and your daughter. And I just wanted you to know that. I mean, something simple is much more resonating. And if you do say the wrong thing, just say, I'm very sorry. I just wanted you to know I was thinking of you. Or walk up and put a cup of coffee on their desk and just say, I was thinking of you today and your daughter, and I wanted to bring you a coffee. And if they say, well, that's not the kind I drink, it's like, well, you know, tell me your order. Let me bring you one tomorrow, you know, or I'll surprise you or something along those lines. Those are the little things that even if they get upset, they remember you showed up.
Eric, in Elena's honor, you and Hannah, your wife, founded the Elena's Voice Foundation. Talk about this.
So we started out, it happened randomly through I saw a suicidal message from a Facebook friend who is a PTSD veteran. We got him mental health services. So Elena's Voice Foundation, 100% of the money we raise goes back to our community. We have no staff, no brick and mortar building, and it goes back to victims of violence. And then now we started a new program to try to get violent offenders that are, you know, first or second offense, that there's a chance that we could get them on the right path, because their children, today's offended or tomorrow's offenders, you know, when they grow up in that, that's what they think it is. So if we can change that trajectory, we can change one family at a time to hopefully try to create positive change in our community.
Lastly, Eric, lessons in loss, love, and resilience. Tell me a bit more about being resilient in these times.
you know, life is hard for all of us. And I think, you know, even in my scenario, I don't look at people as if they don't understand or would never understand grief or loss. There's no way to really rate this in any way, because we all have a story to tell. I find in our society that we don't talk about grief much. And many other cultures really celebrate life and death as a part of the process. So my intention's been to kind of help people start the conversation and help them through these journeys. There's a lot of people that are 20 years into a grief journey that are still stuck and think that they could have fixed it. They go down this what I call the dark road of why. So my public speaking and now best-selling book it's just been really resonating with people, and it's very fulfilling to help others on their journey.
Always November. How do we find out more information, Eric Housley?
They can go to my website, erichousley.com, A-R-I-K, they can Google it and find it. Or it's on amazon.com as well. Like I said, it was a bestseller and number one new release. So, I would love it if they want to check it out, or if it's for somebody that they know that's going through a grief journey.
Thank you again for, practicing what you preach when it comes to living with tragedy, turning your pain into purpose, and, of course, valuing each moment, learning from your good words. Always November. Thank you, Eric.
Thank you.
Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan and partners have committed $375,000 in grants, helping Michigan nonprofits expand access to nutritious food and nutrition education. Much we take for granted. Let's talk about it. The application process for the Nourishing Communities Opportunity. Shannon Carney, Alexic, to discuss. Hi, Shannon. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Shelley.
Yeah, thanks for this opportunity to be your messenger. So let's get into the conversation. What is this grant, this Nourishing Michigan Communities, in your words?
Well, this grant is a partnership between Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan, as you said, but also Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan Foundation and Blue Cross Complete of Michigan. It is designed for Michigan-based nonprofits working to expand nutritious food, strengthen nutrition knowledge, and build sustainable solutions. The real goal is to help make the healthy choice the easy choice for families and communities. And we're really targeting those Michigan-based nonprofits for this opportunity.
The full line to present Nourishing Communities, Nutrition Access, Education, and Impact Grant. What is this, Shannon? Goodness, according to Feeding America, 1.5 million Michigan residents, including 400,000 children, struggle to get enough to eat?
That is true, Shelley. Food insecurity does affect many Michigan communities and affect the health of those community members. We know that individuals that are food insecure have increased risks for chronic diseases like hypertension, diabetes, and heart disease. And also food insecurity can really impact your mental health through stress and anxiety. We know we see this all across the spectrum. Kids who are hungry have challenges learning in school. Adults who are hungry have challenges being attentive in the workplace. So we are really seeking solutions. And those community-based solutions are critically important because we know each community is unique and has individual needs. And that's why we have this request for applications that is open for Michigan communities.
Yes, let's look at some timelines. Here we are on a Monday, the 27th of July. Are applications open?
Applications are currently open. You can find the link to the application either at miBlueDaily.com and also at bcbsm.com. Applications are due on August 14th, so there is some time to complete that application and review the full grant details. And we really encourage any of those on the line to share it broadly with those leaders in your communities that you know are doing this good work around food.
Talk to me about more of the target audience. The grant invites applications from nonprofit organizations, striving to serve communities across Michigan by improving this access. Who needs to apply? And our grants up to, 50,000 will be awarded, yes?
That is correct. Up to $50,000. You have to be a 501c3 organization. And eligible products may include focusing on food distribution infrastructure, local food system improvements. It could be community gardens, nutrition education programs, food rescue efforts, really any initiatives that help increase access to healthy foods and help strengthen nutrition knowledge for community members.
Grants up to $50,000, as we mentioned. And give me an example of a strong proposal. I have about six in front of me.
A strong proposal would really take in the needs of the individual community. They would be, could have multiple partners. It could have buy-in already from community leaders. It could either be establishing, expanding, or enhancing an effort. So really we're looking for the full spectrum. It could be starting something new or building on something that's there right now and making it more sustainable or expanding the impact of that to reach more people, more segments of the population, such as seniors. So the spectrum is broad, but really focusing on sustainable. We're really looking at those investing in strategies that make access to healthy food sustainable into the future.
And you mentioned one of your partners, of course, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan, the foundation, and also Blue Cross Complete of Michigan?
That is correct. We're really proud to be partnering together to bring this opportunity to Michigan communities.
All right. If you don't apply, you don't win, as they say, as a grant is being offered. Details one more time, Shannon.
The Nourishing Communities Grant, please go to miBlueDaily.com or bcbsm.com and apply before August 14th.
Wonderful. All right. Again, we are the messenger, but for such a great opportunity. Thanks, Shannon, for the great conversation. Have a great Monday.
Thank you.
With the American Red Cross calling on you, the public. We must donate blood after the nation's blood supply dropped nearly 25% in June. And you bet some are bringing more trauma cases, fewer donations. Let's talk about the organization that is urging eligible donors to, well, roll up our sleeves and I'll let you finish the conversation. Good morning to you, Dr. Courtney Lawrence, Division Chief Medical Officer at the American Red Cross. Important job you have. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Shelley.
Let me have you back up my introduction. Is the Red Cross literally declaring an emergency blood shortage?
It is. You know, as the single largest blood supplier for the country, the Red Cross has noted that during the month of June, the national blood supply has dropped 25%, and that comes at a really critical period. So between Memorial Day and Labor Day is what we call a high trauma season. It's where we tend to see more serious accidents and injuries and people who come to the hospital in need of blood transfusion.
Wonderful. And what makes summer such a challenging time for nation's blood supply? I think we probably all know the answer. I think we're out of doors more and maybe challenging ourselves to do more challenging activities.
100%, Shelley. So we know that, you know, the great thing about summer is it's a time where people are able to be more active and to get into the outdoors, whether it's hiking, biking, boating, or even simple things like lawn care. We see more cars out on the road traveling to their destination, but alongside that can mean more unanticipated car accidents or injuries. And so we know that someone who's undergone a serious accident could require even dozens of units of blood to support them through that injury. And at the same time, this is a period where we're seeing a real decline in our blood donor turnout. It's a busy season, so our regular blood donors may be on vacation. The schools and the community groups that are often hosting blood drives throughout the year may be on their summer break. And so that's where we start to see that gap between the increased hospital need, but that decrease in our blood donors who are coming in to donate. That's where that gap is really felt.
And this next follow-up question, I'm thinking maybe a summary, but why is it so important for hospitals to have blood readily available? I trust because more of us may be walking in the door needing.
Absolutely. So blood donation, well, blood transfusion in general is really part of the backbone of modern medical care, and having it accessible is really important to maintaining critical access to life-saving therapies. Someone needs a blood transfusion in the United States every 2 seconds, and that could be a mother who's experiencing complications from childbirth, someone who's recovering from surgery, a cancer patient who is undergoing chemotherapy. And, you know, it's important for doctors to have ready access to blood, or else they're forced to make difficult decisions about whether someone can receive the blood transfusion they need now or whether they might have to wait.
Let me ask a two-part question to you, Dr. Courtney Lawrence, again, board-certified physician in blood banking and transfusion medicine. You ask for people to donate regularly, but for someone who's never donated before, what do we know about the donation process? What must we know?
You know, as a transfusion expert, I was really surprised when the Red Cross put out a survey. We found that less than 1 in 5 of our respondents understood that blood has a definite shelf life. So we can't stockpile blood for down the line future use. You know, our red blood cells have a shelf life of 42 days or less. Platelets, which are a critical blood unit that's needed to help someone recover from bleeding, has only 5 days on the shelf before it expires. And so that really highlights the need for donors to come continuously throughout the year to be able to replenish what's on our shelves to provide out to hospitals. At the same time, we saw that only about half of individuals really thought that they or someone that they know might need a blood transfusion in the future. And again, blood transfusions are incredibly common. And even if you think you may never need one, I think many of us hope we may never need one, the real reality is that lots of things in life are unpredictable, and we may find ourselves in the situation where we rely on a blood transfusion to save our life.
Yep, thank you for that reality check. Before I get into our final conversation, Dr. Lawrence, tell me about the word eligibility. Who perhaps would be your best donor, or who should stay away?
So certainly we want someone to make an appointment and to come in to donate when they're feeling generally healthy and well. But I think a lot of people have never thought about whether they're eligible to donate blood. We have found that generally about 2/3 of the American population at any given time is actually eligible to donate blood, and yet only about 3% do choose to come in and give blood. So if anybody has any questions about whether they are eligible, they can go to our eligibility criteria on redcrossblood.org. And when they schedule an appointment to donate blood, they can actually complete a health history screening in advance of that appointment online, and they can find out more information about their blood donation eligibility.
Of course, our conversation should want us all to run and give our blood today, but you have a little special gift, I see, for thanking donors.
That's right. Because the need for blood right now is so high, anyone who comes in to donate blood or platelets before the end of July will receive a Fandango movie ticket by email after their donation, which is just one small way that the Red Cross can say thank you for someone generously taking their time to come in and give the gift of life.
Bet. All right. I trust you're enjoying your time with the responsibilities you personally have with the American Red Cross.
You know, it is a privilege every day to be able to work with people out in the community who really do choose to donate both their time and their blood, and also to partner with hospitals to make sure we're doing right by the patients that we're taking care of.
Wonderful. Day at a time, and yet prevention the key. Thank you very much, Red Cross. American Red Cross calls on the public to donate blood. Thanks to you, Dr. Courtney Lawrence, Division Chief Medical Officer. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Shelley.
He writes the book Running with Lions, described as a simply remarkable story. A tireless advocate for education and equity, among other causes. Let's discuss your latest work. Dr. Pius Kamau on the line. Thank you for your service in both writing a unique story and, of course, working as a thoracic surgeon as well. Dr. Kamau, good morning.
Good morning to you. Shall I call you Shelley?
I think let's just do that. Yes, call me Shelley, because I have not worked as hard as you to earn my MD. I've got a master's, but we'll not digress. Dr. Kamau, thank you for being here. Love the front cover. You, again, yes, an advocate for education equity. You established Africa-America Higher Education Partnerships, a nonprofit we'll talk about. Born in Kenya, trained in Spain in surgical practice, but when did you know you wanted to write a book?
Well, I've been a writer for all my life, I would say. I remember the first time writing on a scrap piece of paper. I must have been about, I don't know, 10 or thereabouts. So I've been a writer all my life, but that said, when I began practice in Denver, I began writing for the Rocky Mountain News and then the Denver Post, and I really did that more or less to train myself in how to write properly, and then the book that I wrote. This particular book, I mean, I began writing about 15 years ago.
Wow.
There were different iterations. Then the last one, which you have in your hands, was written during the COVID pandemic because I had time, more time.
It's the silver lining of that time. Yes, you have been a columnist in beautiful Denver. You're a home away from home. And yet you share running with lions as a boy in colonial Kenya. You learned exactly what it means to run with lions. Tell us a little bit about your storyline.
Well, okay. So running with lions essentially is... the way I look at it is the many hardships that the one has, at least the ones I had, that I lived with as a small boy. My father had tuberculosis. I myself also suffered from a number of conditions, sort of tropical dysentery, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. And poverty itself is a lion that you have. You know, the one travels with, or you know, is a part of the times when I grew up. The Mau Mau war was going on. The British were killing a lot of us, the Kikuyu. A lot of my people were thrown into detention camps, almost like concentration camps. And then along the way, As you may have seen in the book, I was struggling to get an education. I ended up walking to Sudan. That to me was another lion. In the nights of my walking to Sudan, I did encounter wild beasts in the forest.
Mm.
That to me was a lion.
Yes.
Then, of course, I think I had a motor vehicle accident and
yes.
ended up in a hospital for 4 months with severe burns. And that, too, was another lion. So those are the lions, I was thinking about as I wrote the book.
Wonderful front cover as well. Yes, this metaphorical power stalking your people, real leopard that you encountered, yes, along the forest, and many of the time that you have stood eye to eye with the death at your door. Talk to me. You returned to an independent Kenya as a doctor. And you discover oppression has simply changed hands. You want to talk about that?
Yes, of course, yes. Well, when I left Kenya, we had it was, I think about a year after Kenya became independent, and of course, I mean, I was in Europe for 6 years, and in Spain and France and England. Then I went back to Kenya, thinking that things would be completely different. You know, one paints pictures of their homeland when they've been gone for some time. In addition to that, I think with the idea that Kenya was independent, independence was something that was romantic, something wonderful. I mean, it's like our people are now free and they're ruling themselves. And of course, you know, you sort of like I'm saying, you paint a romantic picture of that, only to come back and realize that the poverty that you had before independence did not go away. Things don't change overnight, so to speak. And then, of course, you are, at least I found, the rulers of Kenya, who are now black, were no better than the British who had tortured us, who had ruled us with an iron fist. The Kenya government of Jomo Kenyatta was not much better than the British, except for the fact that the racism that that was practiced when I left was somewhat better, in that whites and blacks and Asians and it could sort of mingle more freely. So tiny talking towards independence, but unfortunately the corruption, the mistreatment of the poor. Then of course another thing which is important to also say is that the elite were now black, and they didn't behave that differently from the British that had ruled us before. You kind of wake up and sort of realize, this is not much different. It's not what I expected.
Right. Dr. Pius, come out with us. Discovering Oppression Has Simply Changed Hands. We're discussing the book, Running with Lions, and of course described as a powerful memoir that traces your journey from dirt poor village boy to physician, eventually to surgeon, proving resilience, intellect, and courage. No color or border. Lastly, remind me, you talk much in the latter part about Anne.
Yes. She was an interesting free Danish woman, but she made my life somewhat easier in a Kenya that was quite poor, it's amazing how some human beings can make one's life more light, I suppose. And she did that. She was a good person, a good lady, and very giving and kind and peaceful. So,
that's good. Yeah, we'll read about that in the latter part. Lastly, you have established Africa-America Higher Education Partnerships. What is this nonprofit?
It's a nonprofit, a 501c3. And my thinking was that what we really need in Africa and what is ignored often is the education of women. So my group thought that the best thing you could do is maybe bring some women scientists from Africa to this country to help them get a graduate education. So here once again, I think, training one woman is almost like training a whole family and training a whole village. So we had some women from Kenya, some women from Uganda, that we brought to this country to get their graduate degrees in engineering and other science subjects.
Nice. Thank you again for that. Running with Lions. Dr. Kamau, how do we find out more information?
Well, I do have a website, piuskamau.com. And of course, one can read, can visit www.ntp.org. I'm on LinkedIn, I'm on Facebook, and you know, if you Google my name, I am. My name is sort of littered all over, over the internet.
Yes, again, that's first names P-I-U-S, last name K-A-M-A-U. Your book, Running with Lions. Thank you very much. Behind a hidden bookshelf door in Amsterdam, a teenage girl, of course, and seven others spent 2 years living in fear, afraid one wrong sound could mean discovery by Nazis. You know we're talking about Anne Frank and her family. Visitors to Griffin Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago can step inside a full-scale recreation of that hidden annex. So I turn to you, Dr. Chevy Humphrey, to talk about this and go from there. Good morning to you.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing fine. Thank you for you. Remind me of the good work of the Griffin Museum of Science and Industry.
We are located in Chicago. The Griffin Museum of Science and Industry was founded in 1933, and our mission is to inspire the inventive genius in everyone. We see about 1.5 million visitors a year, and we're on the south side of Chicago.
Hop and a skip, of course, from our Grand Rapids. Dr. Humphrey, let's talk about why your museum decided to bring this exhibition, this Anne Frank, the exhibition, to Chicago.
So many of our young people are trying to make sense of the world around them, and we see a number of school children every year, and we talk to parents and our community. And it's something that we felt very strongly that people needed to understand Anne's story and her voice. You talk about a 13-year-old that was held in captivity for 2 years in an attic, and she was just trying to make sense of the world around her, and living under these horrible in this horrible situation. Trying to still be a teenager, trying to write about all the things that were happening, but also trying to live her life.
What can visitors expect when we step inside the recreated annex? And I guess how is it different from visiting the Anne Frank House in Amsterdam, which I was privileged to do a couple years ago?
The main difference between this exhibition that's presented here in Chicago versus the Anne Frank House is that the rooms are meticulously designed the way Otto Frank recalled. When you go through the house in Amsterdam, the rooms are empty because Otto Frank wanted the house to remain exactly how the Nazis left it. Here you will see rooms that are meticulously designed to actually show you how they lived in those quarters. In addition, at the house, you have to climb stairs to get to the annex. Here, it is ADA accessible, and everyone has an experience to see the annex, as well as learn about the story of Anne Frank.
Tell me more about the anniversaries of Anne Frank's final diary entry and the annex's discovery, meaningful moments for the exhibition. There's an August 1st and an August 4th that's important.
Yes, we're very excited about presenting this because we are going to be, as I don't know if you know, but we allow every school field trip to come through the exhibition for free. In addition, every school child, when they leave, will be able to have receive their own diary so that they can write and reflect on what they've learned and also to reflect about the world around them and trying to understand it.
And I trust expanding this is such that young people understand the dangers of anti-Semitism and hatred today.
Yes, there's no room for hate, and we hope that they will understand how they can play a part in making this world better. Anne Frank, in her diary, she said, "You need not wait one single moment to start improving the world." And we're hoping that every school child, every visitor that comes through this exhibition, need not wait to make this world better.
Talking with Dr. Chevy Humphrey, President and CEO, Griffin Museum of Science and Industry in our beautiful Chicago. Of course, the Anne Frank, the exhibition. Is your exhibition open as we speak?
Yes, it is. And if you want more information, please go to griffinmsi.org. And information about tickets and visiting will be on our website.
Great. Continue good work to you and the many accolades you have with your doctorate in business administration and more. Thank you for this conversation and the important work Griffin Museum of Science and Industry does. Take care.
Thank you.